lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse.
Gerald Ford is somebody of extremely modest capabilities, but the administration that he led was a turning point in the increased power of this financier cabal over the United States. And this, of course, is something that builds up to 9/11, that looks back to the Kennedy assassination and a whole series of other things. Watergate is not what you think. Watergate is not two crusading journalists, Woodward and Bernstein. Watergate is a coup d'etat brought about by the same bankers clique with the help of CIA, FBI, Henry Kissinger, and the rest. And Gerald Ford is essentially a bit player, a walk-on part in this. And it reminds us that, you know, simply being president of the United States doesn't really indicate very much that you have special power. You can easily be a puppet, as indeed he was. Ford essentially sponsors the careers of so many of the principal operatives of this invisible government down to our own time. Look at the names we've just mentioned. Cheney is the White House Chief of Staff. Rumsfeld is the Secretary of Defense. Alan Greenspan is at the Council of Economic Advisers. George Bush is in there. Bremer, who destroyed Iraq, is on Kissinger's staff. And you can make a very long list. The main heavies of the invisible government that we're plagued with until the present time make the big career leap under Gerald R. Ford. 9/11 is really the key to all of this in our own time. It's essentially that there's a network inside the institutions of the United States. Again, I call it the invisible government. In this case, we're talking about the action arm of the invisible government. We're talking about, in the 1963 case with Kennedy, it's the CIA Operations Directorate and its allies. Now, a lot of that has been privatized, so you're talking essentially about a rogue network that exists inside the Department of Defense, the CIA, the Special Forces Command, the National Security Council, NSA, DIA, the Treasury, you name it. It's all through there. But it's also got a large privatized component in the private military firms, the various defense contractors. The Cold War CIA was essentially privatized into front companies even more than it had been. This group decides that they're going to change the foreign policy of the United States. They're going to attempt to reorganize the world around the war on terror by staging 9/11. Using their patsies, their Al-Qaeda, Atta, Bin Laden, the rest of these people as boogeymen, running the stuff through military drills of the Pentagon and these private military firms. Bush eagerly rushed to capitulate. He was an expendable puppet on 9/11. He knew it. And he did everything he could to show that he was going to go along with what was happening in the same way that Gerald Ford could see that there was a coup d'etat against Nixon and decided to become part of it and to become a beneficiary.
You're listening to episode 685 of Unwelcome Guests, the U.S. Deep State, 1963 to 1981. I'm Robin Upton. We began with Webster Tarpley, from whom we shall hear more in our second hour, and now we're going to hear a section of how Lynn Gerry, this show's first producer, introduced episode number 87, The Red Pill. If you've not heard it before, highly recommended. It's my favorite of the 500 or so shows that she produced. And she is giving voice to my feelings about this episode.
Many of the facts, history, and analyses we'll present tonight have been addressed on previous editions of Unwelcome Guests, but not quite this way. You will have to decide whether these are paranoid ravings or descriptions of truth that, once acknowledged, require a transformation from oblivion to resistance. If what we present to you rings true, I urge you to pass this information to friends, family, co-workers, even strangers, and begin a dialogue with them. I think that this is the most important, provocative, and difficult material that we have presented on this program in the close to 2 years of its existence.
I'm reading an essay by multimillionaire businessman Mark Gorton, and we begin with the covering letter with which he sent it to his employees on the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. 50 years of the Deep State. Dear friends and loved ones, today, November the 22nd, 2013, is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. About 6 years ago, quite by accident, I took a passing interest in the assassination of JFK. My research into the assassination of JFK took me on a path into the dark underbelly of the CIA, and from there I traced a web of criminality that ran through the huge sections of federal government, the political power structure, and the business interests that control our country. As I researched more, I learnt that the criminal network behind JFK's assassination did not retire after his killing. Instead, the need to cover up past crimes has motivated them to commit more crimes in a never-ending cycle that continues to this present day. I have tracked this criminal network through time, and I've learnt that this cabal has been the most significant political force in the United States for the last 50 years. Yet most people don't have any idea that it exists. My research project has grown to be a major interest in my life. I have a total of 180 books on the topics of the JFK assassination and the ensuing actions of the criminal cabal that seized control of our government. 70 of these books I have read cover to cover, and the rest I have either read a particular section or skimmed. I have dozens and dozens of books on my to-read list, as I am continually researching different strands of government criminality. In addition to reading books, I have spent countless hours doing research on the Internet. I now have a profound understanding of the dark forces that control how politics in our country really work. 50 years ago, a network of criminals took control of our government, and they have not let go until the present day. I cannot passively accept living in a country where democracy has been overthrown. Yet I cannot help but feel helpless against the powerful forces that have been systematically killing their opposition for decades. In my desire to heal our democracy, I have searched for answers as to how the powerless can confront the powerful. When confronted with evil that they could not prevent, Quakers have a tradition of bearing witness so that this evil does not pass unnoted. On this 50th anniversary of the coup d'etat known as the JFK assassination, this document is my attempt to bear witness to the crimes of the last 50 years in my hope that, in my own small way, my voice can help repair our country. As I've studied the hidden history of the United States for the last 50 years, I have not only learned of criminal networks embedded within our government, I have also learned the stories of many, many honest Americans who have fought to save our country. These unsung heroes of democracy have fought courageously to save the soul of our country. These Americans have risked their careers and their lives so that our dreams of freedom and democracy would not die. This document is dedicated to the hundreds and hundreds of Americans who have paid with their lives the ultimate price of confronting the cabal embedded within our government. The Coup of 63. Among serious researchers of JFK's assassination, a remarkable unanimity of opinion has been achieved. Thanks to the tens of thousands of man-years of effort that have gone into studying the JFK assassination, the depth and breadth of the plot can be known. The plot was a giant domestic conspiracy that involved elements of the entire U.S. power structure. The assassination of JFK was part of a full-scale coup d'etat, the violent takeover of our government by a group of criminals. I have not the slightest doubt in my mind that JFK's assassination was the work of a network of criminals embedded within the political system and power structure of the United States. Key among the players in the coup of 63 were LBJ, Alan Dulles and the CIA, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, right-wing Texas oil executives, including Clint Murchison Sr., H.L. Hunt, and D.H. Byrd, the East Coast business establishment, centered around Rockefeller interests and the Council on Foreign Relations, Curtis LeMay, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, other right-wing leaders from the military, and elements of the military intelligence, and the Bush family, both Prescott and George H.W. Bush. In 1961, President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned against, quote,
"the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex."
Eisenhower continued,
"the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together."
Perhaps Eisenhower may more accurately have described this threat as the military intelligence complex, as the CIA had been operating free from proper oversight since its founding in 1947. Acting under the cover of protecting the world from communism, powerful interests found American imperialism to be enormously profitable, and the secrecy within the CIA provided the perfect environment for criminal elements to prosper. JFK was aware of these forces, and he chose to fight against them. JFK and his brother RFK took on a host of entrenched, corrupt interests. The CIA, big business, the mafia, and the corrupt Texas interests surrounding LBJ. A huge swath of the American power structure was at risk of being displaced and even ending up in jail by the crusades of the Kennedy brothers. LBJ was incredibly corrupt. He even had his own personal hitman, Mac Wallace, who'd been killing people for a decade to keep LBJ's crimes from being exposed. With RFK as Attorney General, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI could no longer protect the mob. Top mafia chieftains, including Carlos Morcellos and Salvatore Trafficante, risked trading their sweet mafia kingpin lifestyle for a life behind bars, due to RFK's crusade against the mafia. The CIA was out of control, and JFK had vowed to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces. Right-wing Cold Warrior generals in charge of the US military were just itching for a possibly nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and JFK's calls for peace were viewed as being treason among the right-wing set. Leaders of giant companies, used to having a compliant government do their bidding, found that JFK actually looked out for the interests of the little guy. Add on to this the Kennedys' support for the civil rights movement gaining strength in the South, and a huge array of powerful, entrenched, entitled interests was in position to be mobilized to resist change. But potential does not equal action, and it took the political genius of Lyndon Baines Johnson to activate these forces to bring about a coup d'etat. The Kennedys and Johnson were involved in a sub rosa war from the beginning on their administration. Bobby Kennedy was telling the Washington Press Corps that it was open season on LBJ, and Bobby was having the Justice Department feed information on LBJ's corruption to a number of different Senate investigations, any one of which could have ended LBJ's career and started his slide towards prison. But LBJ may not have needed the impetus of fear for his career and freedom to motivate him to kill JFK. As majority leader of the Senate, LBJ was arguably the second most powerful man in Washington. Many of his colleagues were surprised when LBJ accepted the nomination for vice president, an office which his fellow Texan and former Vice President John Garner described as being, quote, "not worth a bucket of warm piss," unquote. Claire Booth Luce asked LBJ why he agreed to be vice president, and LBJ told her that he'd done research and 6 out of 33 presidents had managed to achieve office without being elected. And he told her,
"I'm a gambling man."
But a study of LBJ's history shows that he was anything but a gambling man. In fact, LBJ was a man who left nothing to chance. Most likely, LBJ planned to kill JFK from the moment he considered becoming vice president. Although John F. Kennedy was finally killed in Dallas on November the 22nd, 1963, the plot to kill him was active for at least a couple of years. The first attempt to kill JFK, of which I'm aware, was to take place in Mexico City at the end of June 1962, but was aborted due to last-minute escape problems. From that time on, JFK was a hunted man. Other attempts were planned for Los Angeles, Grand Rapids, Chicago, Tampa, Miami, and Houston. The planned assassination attempt on JFK in Miami on June 18, 1963, was foiled when people loyal to JFK leaked word of the plot and the planned motorcade was cancelled in favor of helicopter transport. By the time November 22nd rolled around, LBJ was getting increasingly desperate. The December 6, 1963 issue of Life magazine, due to be printed and mailed on November the 29th, 1963, was set to run an expose of Lyndon Johnson's corruption that could have ended his career. The earlier plots to kill JFK that were designed with more distance between the coup plotters and the trigger man had failed, and now Johnson risked more active involvement by having his people directly orchestrate both the motorcade planning and the take-apart of the President's Secret Service protection. By the time JFK's motorcade rolled through Dallas, little had been left to chance. As Chauncey Holt said, quote,
"There were more mercenaries in Dealey Plaza that day than at a Soldier of Fortune convention," unquote.
The success of the coup depended not only upon the ability of the shooters to escape undetected, but upon the certitude that the cabal behind the assassination could control the investigation and the story reported in the media. JFK had no idea how little chance he had of making it through Dealey Plaza alive. The Dallas police protection of the motorcade route ended right at the start of Dealey Plaza. In fact, one of the shooters was probably a Dallas police officer. The Secret Service protection surrounding JFK was removed. In my estimate, 6 shooters awaited from a variety of vantage points. The Secret Service agent driving JFK's car brought the car to a complete stop, and a barrage of shots from all directions converged on JFK. After confirming that JFK had been killed, JFK's driver put the car in motion and continued driving. The coup of 63 did not end with the killing of JFK. The shooting part of the assassination was relatively small compared to the cover-up. The planning for the cover-up was built into the fabric of the plot. Lee Harvey Oswald was set up as the patsy. Oswald did not fire a shot in Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA contract agent who'd been sent into Russia as a fake defector. He then returned to the US and used his time in Russia as an entry into the left-wing pro-Castro movement. Lee Harvey Oswald is a fairly minor character in the coup of 63, but through him a multi-layered counterintelligence plot can be seen. The coup of 63 had within it many, many contingency strategies built. The coup went almost according to plan. The only thing that went wrong on November the 22nd, 1963, was that the Dallas police failed to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, so Jack Ruby was tasked with the ensuing killing of Oswald. However, the coup plotters had no way of knowing that things would go so smoothly, so they embedded within Oswald a variety of cover stories which could have been deployed under different scenarios. Oswald could have been made to look like a racist, a Cuban, a Russian, or even to have mob ties. However, since the coup went so close to plan, he was declared to be a lone nut and dismissed as such. The contingencies beyond how to blame Oswald were much more serious. If it were superficially obvious that JFK's killing was the result of a conspiracy, Castro was to be blamed, and an invasion of Cuba was to quickly follow. Many anti-Castro Cubans who participated in the coup were deeply disappointed that the invasion of Cuba never materialized. My studies of the coup of 63 have led me to believe that even graver fallback strategies were embedded in the plot. If JFK's killing was obviously perceived as being part of a large conspiracy, and the US public was not buying the Castro did it angle, the coup plotters were truly in dire straits. These desperate men who ran the military, the FBI, some of the largest companies in the world, and the US government, faced the prospect of being hung for treason. I believe that the darkest scenarios envisioned by the coup plotters involved declaring martial law and blaming the Russians and taking the country to, and possibly over, the brink of nuclear war with Russia. Interestingly, the Russian intelligence was aware of the plans to kill Kennedy, and they were aware that through Lee Harvey Oswald they were to be set up to take the blame. So, in September of 1963, the KGB attempted to kill Lee Harvey Oswald to prevent themselves from being sucked into a false war. But the assassination capabilities of the Russians within the United States were fairly limited, and the KGB were unable to kill Oswald. The cover-up. Elaborate plans for the cover-up of JFK's assassination went into action after his killing. JFK's body was secretly rushed to Washington, D.C., aboard Air Force Two, while an empty casket sat in the hold of Air Force One, and LBJ countermanded Secret Service advice and stalled takeoff by demanding to be sworn in on the tarmac in Dallas. JFK's body was then worked on in pre-autopsy surgery to reconstruct his skull and hide the nature of his wounds. The autopsy itself was conducted at Bethesda Naval Hospital outside of Washington, D.C., under control of the top military brass. The clearest evidence of the military involvement in the coup can be seen in the handling of the autopsy. The lead agency in the cover-up was the FBI. The FBI was pushing the Oswald did it, case closed, party line within 2 hours of JFK's death. The entire FBI investigation was aimed at convicting Oswald and ignoring or destroying any evidence that pointed in another direction. Witness intimidation was frequently employed for anyone who had testimony that contradicted what the FBI wanted to hear. When, despite the most earnest pronouncements of J. Edgar Hoover, the public still was skeptical of the official version of who killed JFK, LBJ put together the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission was made up of some of the most eminent men in the country, including Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren. The Warren Commission was designed to approve the already firm FBI conclusions, and, with a bit of extra process, it did exactly that. JFK's bitter enemy and coup leader, Alan Dulles, was the most active member of the Warren Commission. Key other commission members active in the cover-up were Council of Foreign Relations Chairman John McCloy, Gerald Ford, and Earl Warren himself. Commission member Senator Richard Russell was a man of great integrity, and despite his being LBJ's mentor in the Senate, he insisted on issuing a dissenting report. However, Senator Russell's report was suppressed and only surfaced decades later in his private papers. The Warren Commission had no investigative resources of its own, and it replied completely upon FBI investigators. The Warren Commission did interview witnesses, but it cherry-picked the witnesses to obtain testimony that favored its preordained conclusions. Warren Commission staff attorneys steered witnesses away from relevant insights and also falsified testimony in order to cover up inconvenient facts that happened to poke through. The threat of nuclear war was embedded in the fabric of the plot, which was used to cow business, media, and government leaders who, under other circumstances, would not have gone along with a cover-up of the assassination, into tacitly working with the coup plotters. The media complicity in the coup of 63 can be traced in part to the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. Elite members of the CFR, such as Alan Dulles, Nelson Rockefeller, George Herbert Walker Bush, and McGeorge Bundy, were sponsors of the JFK assassination. CFR members Alan Dulles, John McCloy, and Gerald Ford played dominant roles in the Warren Commission cover-up of the coup d'etat. A remarkable fraction of the publishers, editors, and senior reporters of the most important media outlets in the country were also members of the Council on Foreign Relations, including Henry Luce, publisher of Time Life, Claire Booth Luce, Arthur Ox Salzberger, publisher of the New York Times, William Paley, owner of CBS, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, and Bob Schiffer, all CBS, Peter Jennings, ABC, James Reston, Anthony Lewis, and Harrison Salisbury, all New York Times, Jack Valenti, Daniel Shaw, and in later days Rupert Murdoch, Michael Eisner, Bill Clinton, George Stephanopoulos, and Brian Williams. The list goes on and on. Any questioning of the Warren Commission involved impugning the honor of their CFR colleagues who ran the Warren Commission, and any serious investigation of the JFK assassination would have risked accusing their fraternity brothers of treason. The secrets of JFK's assassination were so close to home that ignorance and denial were safer than the truth. Now, some reporters weren't part of this club and doggedly tried to find the truth. Reporters who could not be controlled were murdered by the criminals running the government. Over the years, certainly 50, and more likely more than 100 people have been killed to preserve the secrets of the coup of 63. Many witnesses, reporters, people who knew too much, plot members at risk of being exposed, overzealous law enforcement officials have all been killed. Some of these deaths were clearly violent. Many were made to look like something else. Anyone who was a threat to the exposure of the cabal that took over the government had to be neutralized. In order to do this, the cabal behind the coup of 63 built a mechanism of domestic death squads, and also the mechanism to cover up these crimes. The quickening of the cabal. The criminals who took over the government had an incredible fear of being exposed. If exposed, they would be hung for treason. Fear of exposure bound the network behind the coup of 63 into an incredibly powerful political force which has dominated the American federal political system for the last 50 years. The assassination continues to be an important event that every American should take the time to understand, because the powerful forces that seized control of our government 50 years ago have not let go. As I studied the coup of 63, I began to perceive this cabal behind JFK's assassination, and as I've studied their actions, I've understood their desperate need to control the American political system. If the cabal were ever to lose control of the American political system, they risk exposure for a litany of crimes which continue to this present day. 6 years ago, I started studying the JFK assassination out of curiosity, but as I came to understand the coup of 63, and I was able to perceive the cabal behind the coup as an incredible political force, I began to study a series of events. Many of these events were also conspiracies, dismissed as crazy by the mainstream media, and I saw that these conspiracies were the work of the same network of people. And what I've been doing for the last several years has been tracking the work of this evolving cabal through time. In order to escape justice for their heinous crimes, the cabal needed to build a number of capabilities for themselves. The cabal needed to be able to kill with impunity anyone who threatened to expose them. They needed to be able to control the press. They needed to control the presidency, federal law enforcement agencies, and the intelligence community. Operating under the secret cover of national security from within the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the ONI, military intelligence, etc., the cabal has been able to systematically destroy threats to itself. With control of the FBI, Justice Department, DEA, ATF, etc., the cabal has been able to ensure that no serious investigation into its crimes would take place, and massive, highly successful programs to control the press, like the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, have ensured that the mainstream media would systematically ignore and dismiss all claims of high-level government corruption. With the control of law enforcement, intelligence agencies, and the press, the cabal built itself the perfect machine for committing crimes and getting away with them. And with these capabilities, the cabal has run amok for the last 50 years. The assassination of RFK. The RFK assassination gives a good idea of the capability of this system. Bobby Kennedy knew that his brother had been killed by a conspiracy. He had a vague sense of the outlines of this conspiracy, but trapped within the Johnson administration, he lacked the power to determine the truth for sure. Bobby's plan was to wait until he could attain the presidency, and then, with the full power of the presidency, he would relentlessly hunt down his brother's killers and avenge JFK's death. The cabal could not allow RFK to become president, and from the moment they seized power, they worked relentlessly to build the mechanism to let them kill Bobby Kennedy and cover up the truth behind his killing. The cabal acquired a variety of mechanisms to kill their enemies. One such mechanism was to use special forces operatives from the US military who'd been trained to obey orders unquestioningly, and once told that someone was an enemy of the state, they would ignorantly and dutifully dispatch this person. Since World War II, the Mafia and the CIA had developed a close, mutually supportive relationship. In many cases, mob hitmen could be deployed on behalf of their intelligence and political masters. Within the CIA and other intelligence organizations were cold-blooded hitmen who knew well that they were part of a criminal network embedded within the government. In addition, many alliances existed between international intelligence agencies. Assassination capabilities were often traded between these agencies. In cases of a high-profile killing where a patsy was needed, brainwashed killers from the CIA's MK-Ultra program could be deployed. Since the early 1950s, the CIA's MK-Ultra program had been using drugs, hypnosis, and a combination of other techniques to produce robot assassins. Not long after Bobby Kennedy declared his candidacy for president, an assassination team stalked and killed Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. This assassination team was composed of the primary shooter, Thane Eugene Caesar, dressed as a security guard, MK Ultra subject Sirhan Sirhan, who discharged his gun wildly, and a network of handlers and other helpers. In case that lone nut cover of Sirhan Sirhan didn't hold, the RFK killing was designed to be blamed on first the Palestinians, and then a combination of the Russians and Aristotle Onassis. Onassis hated Bobby Kennedy and wanted him out of the way, so he could marry Jackie Kennedy. Onassis was brought into the plot by intelligence operatives, and he did fund some of the assassination plot. Although Onassis was involved in the plot to kill RFK, the hierarchy behind the assassination was headed by LBJ. Just as with the killing of JFK, the cover-up of RFK's assassination was a larger operation than the killing itself. During the early 1960s, the CIA engaged in joint training exercises with local police departments across the country. Nominally, the training was intended to improve federal-local cooperation on intelligence matters. In reality, these exercises provided a mechanism for the CIA to control local police investigations across the country. Manuel Pina, the LAPD officer with control of the RFK assassination, had previously worked doing special ops for the CIA. He'd worked closely with David Morales, a CIA hitman who had a significant operational role in the JFK assassination. Beyond developing assassination and cover-up capabilities, the 5 years between the coup of 63 and RFK's killing had allowed the cabal to consolidate their control of the press. CIA agents were inserted as reporters and editors at all of the major media outlets in the country. The meme that conspiracy theorists were kooks was developed within the CIA and deployed with great effectiveness. During the 1960s, the overwhelming mass of news information reaching the eyes and ears of Americans came from 15 organizations: NBC, ABC, CBS, AP, UPI, Time Life, McGraw-Hill, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, New York Times, Washington Post, Metro Media, Westinghouse, Capital Cities, the North American Newspaper Alliance, and the Saturday Evening Post. The cabal was successful in co-opting the top management at each of these organizations and enlisting them into active involvement in the cover-up of the coup of 63. During the period 1964-68, internal research teams in several of these organizations reached the conclusion that the Kennedy assassination had been the result of a conspiracy. In each and every case, management at the highest editorial and corporate level took actions to overrule, suppress, lock up, edit, or otherwise alter these internal findings to back up the conclusions of the Warren Commission. Project Mockingbird was a CIA program to control the U.S. press. The exact size of Project Mockingbird remains classified, but bits of information have slipped out over time that allow for budgetary estimates to be computed. In 1978, the CIA propaganda budget was estimated to be $265 million and involved 2,000 personnel, making it larger than the combined budgets of Reuters, the Associated Press, and United Press International. In 1977, Carl Bernstein reported that the CIA had over 400 reporters and editors at major U.S. media outlets on its payroll. Descendants of this program continue up until the present day. The cabal behind the coup of 63's ongoing battle to control the presidency. Controlling the presidency was a key for the cabal members behind the coup of 63. With Bobby Kennedy out of the way, the cabal worked to steer the 1968 election to Richard Nixon by using agents provocateurs to instigate riots in Chicago at the 1968 Democratic Convention. In addition, the anti-war reform political coalition that was beginning to coalesce around Martin Luther King was neutralized by the state-sponsored killing of MLK. Dr. King's assassination was organized by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, military intelligence, and elements of the Memphis Police Department. New Orleans mafia kingpin Carlos Marcello, who played a meaningful role in JFK's assassination, played a significant role in Martin Luther King's killing. In the case of the Dr. King's assassination, James Earl Ray was the patsy who was set up to take the blame, although he had no involvement in the shooting. The actual assassination was handled by elements of the Memphis police, with help from the local mafia at the request of Carlos Marcello. A backup team of army snipers, Operation Detachment Alpha 184 team, under the direction of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, were also present in Memphis the day of the assassination as a backup in case the Mafia and Memphis Police Department team did not get the job done. Although the military snipers had MLK in their sights, they were not required to fire. Nixon's relationship with the cabal. Nixon was not a cabal member, but he was controllable. Nixon's political career had been sponsored by cabal members Prescott Bush and the Dulles brothers, and their Eastern business establishment allies. During his first term, Nixon grappled with the CIA, but did nothing serious to rein in its excesses. As the cabal behind the coup of 63 positioned itself for the 1972 election, Nixon still seemed to be the best option for them. Nixon had a reputation for using dirty tricks, and Nixon was certainly no angel, but much of the dirty criminal political tricks done on Nixon's behalf were the work of a network of people loyal not to Nixon, but the cabal. The 1968-72 period saw the emergence of a young Karl Rove under the tutelage of CIA asset Robert Bennett and political slime master Donald Segretti. Segretti, Rove and Company conducted a series of disinformation campaigns against strong Democratic candidates Edmund Muskie, Edward Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey and Henry Jackson, ensuring that Nixon would face off against the fairly weak George McGovern. The promised entrance into the 1972 presidential race of George Wallace as a third-party candidate threatened to drain votes from Nixon and throw the election to the Democrats. To neutralize Wallace, the cabal decided to have him killed. A network of people, including Rove's mentor, Donald Segretti, coordinated the shooting of Wallace, which didn't kill him but left Wallace paralyzed and knocked him out of the race, ensuring Nixon's election. Once Nixon was elected to his second term as president, he achieved a degree of independence that made him a danger to the cabal. Deep down, Nixon was never as corrupt as core cabal members, and towards the end of his first term, he began making plans to purge the entire senior leadership of the CIA. Unfortunately, Nixon didn't realize that the CIA had the White House bugged and his senior staff filled with spies, so the cabal leadership was well aware of Nixon's plans. Nixon had a reputation for being paranoid, yet he was not paranoid enough. His enemies had him surrounded to a degree which he did not understand. Although cabal members put Nixon on his path to power, they never trusted Nixon, and as early as 1966, before Nixon was even an official candidate for president, the cabal worked to booby-trap Nixon's administration. And in 1973, after Nixon had stopped being a compliant servant of the cabal, they set off the booby trap in the form of the Watergate coup, and they pulled Nixon down from power just as they had put him up. The traditional story of Watergate is one where Nixon does a bunch of bad things, gets caught, tries to cover it up, and is forced to resign. However, in reality, Watergate was a plot by the cabal behind the coup of 63, and corrupt elements within the CIA and military intelligence to depose Nixon. By 1973, the original leaders of the cabal were dying off. Alan Dulles died in 1969, J. Edgar Hoover in 1972, and LBJ in 1973. The death of their leaders created a power vacuum at the top of the cabal. And as the cabal was fighting off threats from the outside world, an internal battle was taking place for control of the cabal and ultimately the control of power in America. Three factions fought for power. A network of old boys from the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the World War II precursor to the CIA, a group within the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, and a group within the CIA led by George H.W. Bush. The Watergate coup served several purposes, but perhaps its most lasting impact was to ensconce George H.W. Bush as the new head of the cabal. George H.W. Bush's father was Prescott Bush, who was the best friend of Alan Dulles. Dulles dominated the CIA from 1953 until he was fired by JFK in the wake of the Bay of Pigs disaster. Like his father, George H.W. Bush was a graduate of Yale and a member of Skull and Bones. In a world where connections and pedigree mattered, George H.W. Bush was the crown prince within the CIA. The first stages of the Watergate coup involved creating a fake scandal to force the resignation of Vice President Spiro Agnew. With Agnew out of the way, the Watergate coup plotters were free to place one of their own in position to take the presidency. Nixon wanted to appoint John Connally of Texas as vice president, but Connally was not a cabal member, so the Republican establishment loyal to Bush threatened to block Connally's nomination, and Nixon was forced to pick a vice president acceptable to the cabal. Gerald Ford, as a member of the Warren Commission, had played a key role in covering up the coup of 63. Ford was not an inner circle member of the cabal behind the coup of 63, but he was solidly aligned with them and could be counted on to support and enable the secret government structures buried within the national security state. The Watergate burglars themselves were headed by CIA agent E. Howard Hunt. Hunt had been a key operational player in the coup of 63. He was even clearly photographed as one of the three tramps arrested near Dealey Plaza immediately after the shooting of JFK. On his deathbed, Hunt confessed to his involvement in the coup of 63 and named LBJ as the leader of the plot. To execute the Watergate break-in, Hunt rounded up some old Cuban comrades who had also been active in supporting JFK's assassination. To those in the know, the makeup of the Watergate burglars was a clear signal that Watergate was a plot on behalf of the cabal behind the coup of 63. To execute the disinformation campaign surrounding Watergate, the Watergate coup plotters turned to ex-naval intelligence officer Bob Woodward, who'd been inserted into the Washington Post. Woodward then proceeded to craft a series of stories that make up much of the myth of Watergate that we know today. In order to complete the takedown of Nixon, the president had to be denied the due process which could have allowed him an effective legal defense before the House Judiciary Committee, where the impeachment resolutions regarding Watergate had been referred. At this time, in 1973, a young Hillary Clinton was working as a staff lawyer for the committee. Even this early in her career, Clinton showed her willingness to ally herself with powerful, corrupt interests. Clinton, along with several other staff members of the committee, conspired to deny Nixon access to legal counsel. In order to pull this off, Hillary wrote a fraudulent legal brief and confiscated public documents to hide her deception. Her boss, Jeffrey Zeifman, later fired Hillary for her unethical actions and said about Hillary, quote, "She was a liar. She was an unethical, dishonest lawyer. She conspired to violate the Constitution, the rules of the House, the rules of the committee, and the rules of confidentiality." Unquote. The Ford Administration. Surrounded by enemies and facing a concerted pressure campaign, Nixon agreed to resign, thus putting Gerald Ford in the White House. Ford populated his administration with men committed to empowering and protecting the secret government. Dick Cheney served as Ford's chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense, and George H.W. Bush was made head of the CIA. This group would assume leadership roles in the secret government infrastructure. George H.W. Bush, more than any individual, assumed responsibility for maintaining the evil secrets of the coup of 63 and the waves of criminality that ensued. Bush took control of a CIA which was under siege. Congressional investigations by the Pike and Church committees had led to revelations about many of the dark secrets within the CIA. Congressional and public pressure demanded reform at the CIA. Despite his decades-long involvement as a deep CIA insider, Bush was falsely brought in as an outsider who would reform the CIA. Bush's real job was to staunch the flow of secrets out of the CIA and prevent the exposure of the truly explosive evil truths of the now multiple coups d'état executed by the CIA. Bush was able to stabilize the secret government mechanisms within the CIA, but the ongoing pressure for reform made the CIA an unsafe base from which to work. Backlash from Watergate was creating a political reform movement that was hard to stop, so the decision was made to move the many mechanisms of the secret government into the private sector. A large private intelligence industry was created and populated by ex-CIA men. David Attlee Phillips, who played a key operational role in the coup of 63, took early retirement from the CIA in 1975 and formed the Association of Retired Intelligence Officers, which served in some ways as a trade association for cabal members. George H.W. Bush serves as the chairman of the Honorary Board of Directors. In the 1976 presidential election, government reform backlash propelled Jimmy Carter into office. As president, Carter purged the CIA of its top 400 officers, and for the first time since its creation in 1947, a high level of scrutiny kept the CIA from operating out of control. Deprived of its main base within the government, the cabal, now under the leadership of George H.W. Bush, worked primarily out of a network of private and international organizations. Key among these organizations was the Safari Club, a working group of international intelligence agencies. The network of ex-CIA agents who had participated in the coup of 63 was able to continue their unsupervised extra-governmental work through this network of intelligence agencies. The creation of the Safari Club coincided with the consolidation of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the BCCI, nicknamed the Bank of Crooks and Criminals. In addition to laundering money, the BCCI served as an intelligence-gathering mechanism by virtue of its extensive contacts with underground and underworld organizations worldwide. The Carter Administration and the Republican Counter-Surprise. During the Carter administration, the Cabal spent much effort on a series of rearguard actions to keep the truth about their domestic assassinations from being recognized. Forces battling for justice against the Cabal were able to launch the United States House of Representatives Select Committee on Assassinations, the HSCA, which operated from 1976 to 78. Despite fairly effective efforts within Congress to sabotage the HSCA, the HSCA did pose large problems for the Cabal. Honest investigators within the HSCA were more or less on the trail of the conspirators in JFK's killing. Many individuals involved in the coup of 63 were scheduled to testify before the HSCA. In order to prevent these actors from testifying, the death squads operated by the Cabal worked overtime. 21 people involved in the coup who were subpoenaed to testify before the committee died under mysterious circumstances. Many died just before their scheduled testimony. For example, in 1977, 7 senior FBI officials called to testify at the HSCA died within a 6-month period. Licking their wounds and biding the time, the power control group, now under the direction of George H.W. Bush, worked to retake control of the presidency. George H.W. Bush was such a pivotal figure because he bridged 2 separate worlds. He was a deep CIA insider, a lifelong intelligence operative, and he also came from an elite family and was intimately tied to the East Coast business elite. His father, Prescott, had been managing partner at the Wall Street investment bank Brown Brothers Harriman, and also a U.S. senator. The Bush and Rockefeller families were very close. George H.W.'s grandfather Samuel had been business partners with John D. Rockefeller's brother, and over the generation the Bush and Rockefeller clans had remained close. Empowered with these dual networks, George H.W. Bush could work within the dark nether realms of the intelligence community, as well as the Republican power elite. After Ronald Reagan defeated Bush in the Republican primary, Bush's powerful allies worked to get him chosen for the Republican vice presidential candidate. Reagan did not like Bush and did not want him as vice president, but David Rockefeller and the Republican establishment made it clear to Reagan that their backing for him depended upon him accepting Bush as his running mate. As the 1980 presidential election rolled around, the now Bush-led cabal worked to prevent Carter's re-election. During 1980, the 52 Americans held hostage by Iran hung like a dark cloud over the Carter administration. Carter was working desperately to have the hostages returned. The Republicans feared a pre-election release of the hostages would give Carter a huge popularity boost and lead to his re-election. A last-minute event of significance before an election is known as an October surprise. In order to prevent this October surprise, the CIA Old Boy Network associated with the Cabal sabotaged Carter's attempts to rescue the hostages, and also sabotaged Carter's secret negotiations with the Iranians, and offered the Iranians an even better deal. Old-school CIA operative Bill Casey led negotiations with the Iranians, in which the Cabal agreed to pay the Iranians $40 million and to ship billions of dollars of weapons stolen from the U.S. military stockpiles in Europe to the Iranians in exchange for the Iranians holding the hostages until Reagan became president. The Republican counter-surprise operation demonstrated the capabilities of the forces of the secret government to operate counter to the legal chain of command. The secret network of individuals within the CIA and military who were loyal to a parallel reporting hierarchy created logistical supply chains from Europe to Iran and looted billions of dollars of weapons from the NATO weapons stores under orders of people who were nominally just civilians. The Iranians were not content to accept Bill Casey as a high enough authority to seal the deal. They demanded to meet with either Reagan or Bush, so George H.W. Bush flew to Paris for face-to-face meetings with the Iranians to close the deal. Pressed for time because of a speaking engagement back in Washington, D.C., Bush returned from Paris in the world's fastest plane, an SR-71, which refueled over the Atlantic and got him home in time for his talk. The Republican counter-surprise came very close to being exposed, and once again the hit squads were active, killing many operatives who had the misfortune of being involved in this latest act of treason on Bush's part. In addition to assuring that the Republicans would occupy the White House, the Republican counter-surprise served another very important purpose. By agreeing to go along with the counter-surprise operation, Reagan compromised himself. Reagan had now acquiesced to committing an act of treason. By committing this crime, Reagan was now in no position to push back against other crimes by members of the cabal, because now he risked exposure himself if the mechanisms of the secret government were disclosed. Now, that's certainly not the end of the essay. Gordon has a lot more to say about the Bush family, and I suspect we shall hear that in our next episode. For now, Peter Dale Scott speaking in 2013 on The Overworld.
It's quite clearly established, I think, in American foreign policy that when it began, from my point of view, to be derailed away from defense and into offense, or alternative, if you like, the defense of U.S. corporations overseas, was a series of actions in the 50s. We got involved in Iran on behalf of what used to be called Anglo-Iranian Oil and is now familiar as BP, the people who despoiled the Gulf. Right after that, in Guatemala, we overthrew a democratically elected government on behalf of United Fruit because this Arbenz government had nationalized those areas of United Fruit property that were not actually being involved in the cultivation of sugar and bananas, and had the audacity to reimburse the company at the rate which they had valued the land for tax purposes. So we invaded that country. Now, where does the overworld come in here? There's something in New York called the Council on Foreign Relations. And before these actions, particularly the action in Guatemala, before they were extensively acted on in governmental level, they were already being discussed in the Council on Foreign Relations, which brings together, well, professors, people I know, but also and leaders in government, but along with leaders from these corporations like United Fruit, and from the law firms that represent them, like Sullivan and Cromwell, where the Dulles brothers lived before they took a step down to become Secretary of State and the head of the CIA. And all these things are thoroughly discussed there first and then become policy. And the general model I wanted to suggest is that historians work with documents and they chronicle how policies emerge at the governmental level, but they should really also be chronicling at the overworld level, the level of the supramonde. And particularly, the CIA itself was an idea, I think, which came out of the war-peace